But I rejoiced greatly in the Lord, that at last your care for me has blossomed again. You were indeed caring for me before, but you lacked the opportunity. We find ourselves now, my beloved, at the end of the epistle of the Apostle Paul. He has touched on many matters of a purely spiritual nature, even though the occasion for writing the epistle was the money the Philippians had sent him. Yet here, you see the spiritual man. When he receives material help, he takes care to answer by using it as an occasion to speak about spiritual matters. And for this very reason, this epistle is full of the Spirit of God. It has so many spiritual things to say. He has spoken of so much and written so much in his epistle. And yet his personal matter, the very thing which, as I told you, became the reason the epistle was written, he leaves until the end. Now, when he is about to finish the epistle completely, although, if he were a man who looked at things in a private and self-serving way, he could have written about this first, or confined himself only to this. Spiritual people, even from material things, take an occasion to write, to speak, and to move in the direction of spiritual matters. So the time has come for him to speak about a personal matter. It concerns his receiving the gift, the donation of money, which the Philippians sent him through Epaphroditus. And with this subject, he also brings the epistle to a close. But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. I rejoiced in the Lord exceedingly, because now at last your concern for me has flourished again, though you were indeed concerned for me. But you lacked opportunity. Let me give it to you in the interpretation, as it is recorded here in Holy Scripture. I rejoiced very greatly with joy in the Lord, because at last your concern for me has now blossomed again. You did have this concern in the past as well, and you were thinking of me and caring for me, but no opportunity was given to you to show this indeed. I do not say these things because I am in want and suffering, and so on. Here there is, as John Chrysostom says, a small rebuke, and at the same time a great praise. The rebuke is overshadowed by the praise, but still, he mingles the rebuke with the praise, or, if you prefer, the praise with the rebuke. Yes, but that is, you did send me these things. But this is how you ought to have been thinking all along. And indeed, you were thinking this way all along. Only, the opportunity was not given to you. But you lacked opportunity. This is a very subtle rebuke. Very subtle. It is as though he reminds them what they ought to have done. They did not do it. And yet he justifies them by saying, yes, you were caring, but you did not have the occasion to show what you cared about. And nevertheless, despite this, you did show your concern. In other words, he turns the matter around in order to say, I am rebuking you, but because you showed concern, not only once, but even twice, as he will say below, I am also praising you. What exactly is this? It is the care that must exist. The Apostle Paul himself says this elsewhere. In another epistle of his, the care that the flock must have for its shepherds. Indeed, he writes it. To see this very spirit in the passage from Titus, with which he also brings his letter to a close, Titus is the bishop of Crete, and the apostle is in Nicopolis of Illyricum, that is near Pravaza. He sends him the letter, and tells him, send me these fellow workers. And when you send them on their way, diligently, so that they may lack nothing. Let our people also learn to be first in good works. For with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. Please keep this passage in mind, so you can see how it is reflected, not only in the verse we are speaking about now, but in the whole passage of Paul here to the Philippians. For with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. Keep this in your mind. Remember it later on. You will see that the apostle is referring to this point in his letter to the Philippians. In other words, what does send them on their way diligently mean? It means, send them from Crete to me after you have prepared them, so that nothing is lacking to them on the road. That is, let them have every comfort, money, food, clothing, whatever they may need for their journey. Send them on diligently so that nothing may be lacking to them, so that they lack nothing, and he notes afterward. Let our people also learn, let the spiritual people learn. Our people, our own, our flock. Let our people also learn to take the lead in good works, to stand first, to be leaders in good works. And what are these good works? Something like this. Very thing you are now going to do, because I am writing to you, send them on diligently. Why? because these are apostles who are being sent into the work of God, and they place their heads under countless dangers. These, then, you must send on diligently, once the flock has learned how it must act and how it must stand before them. This is why he gives the Philippians this rebuke. But here you will see the dignified character of Paul, who will tell us a little further on that he never took anything from any church, and that no church even thought to give him anything, none, except the Philippians. John Chrysostom says that this is great praise for the Philippians, and yet they too had shown something. That phrase, "but you lack the opportunity," the apostle balances it in such a way that he can say it and cover it at the same time. He moves quickly away from this point so that the Philippians will not fall into despondency, become troubled, or be grieved. And because certain problems had arisen in the relationship between him and the Corinthian church, the apostle even reaches the point of saying that he would rather die than receive anything from them. And not because he does not love them. The Lord knows that he loves them. But he does this so as not to give an occasion to some who are ready to accuse him. For this reason, my beloved, the apostle Paul was a man who worked and earned his money. What money? Money for the gospel, so that he could cover the expenses of the gospel. What expenses to charter a boat, to hire whatever was needed for travel? At one point, they specifically paid for a boat, that is, a ship, to leave from above, Troas, and come to Syria, to rent. To charter a boat in those days, a ship, required a great deal of money. And marvel at this, the apostle says this to the Ephesians, to the priests of Ephesus. Precisely on that voyage, on that journey, he says, "From you I took nothing. I coveted no one's silver or gold or clothing." But what does he say? "These hands, these very hands, my calloused hands, served my needs and the needs of my fellow workers." The apostle is truly a magnificent personality. How he acts, how he not only sees and lives Christian dignity, but also how he thinks for the gain of the gospel. He himself says somewhere that he has the right to receive his support from the churches, yet he does not do it. Why? So that the ministry of the gospel may not be blamed, may not be accused, and so that he may give the image of offering the gospel of Christ without cost. The word is his own, the gospel of Christ, without cost, so that the gospel may suffer no loss whatever. That is, the whole cause of the gospel. You understand what a great figure he is, and how he thinks. He is truly a person to imitate. But let us see how the text moves through this matter of the gift. You see how his gratitude, his thousand thank yous, are woven together with his Christian dignity, his self-sufficiency, and at the same time with his attitude toward material needs. Precisely within this movement from one point to another, we see all the richness of the apostle's personality. "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly. I rejoiced very much." When we offer someone a gift, we suppose that he rejoices. The apostle does the same. He rejoices. But he preserves the spirit of that joy, that phrase, "in the Lord, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly." He says this to forestall the thought that he rejoiced over the gift as such. "Do not think that I am a greedy man, who, when money is given to him, says, 'Oh, what great joy I have today. I received money.'" You have seen people when they receive money, when they receive gifts, whatever they receive, whatever happens to come their way, you know, you see how they rejoice. So, in order not to give the suspicion that his joy is precisely because he received something, because the Philippians sent him something, he says that phrase, "in the Lord." "My joy is great in the Lord." Why? "Because you showed this attitude toward me. Not then, because of what you sent me, but because of what you showed." What did you show? "That your care for me has blossomed again. That it sprouted again within you, to blossom again." To sprout again is an image from the plant kingdom. The desire, the longing to think of me, has sprouted again within you. For if you are thinking of me, you are thinking of the gospel. And if you are thinking of the gospel, you are thinking of the gospel. You are thinking of Christ. For I have identified my own life with the gospel. And truly, whether you say Paul or you say the gospel, it is the same thing. So I rejoiced, because you had your thought on me and for me, now that I am imprisoned. Do not forget this. Paul is imprisoned. He can no longer sit again at his loom, weave, and earn money in order to live. Paul is in prison, and there he cannot work in order to have what he needs for his expenses, If you also bear in mind that there were two categories of prisoners, those who were serious convicts, whom the state fed, and those who were not serious convicts, whom their relatives cared for, bringing food to the prison, from where would Paul receive anything? He had then to receive from others, in order to eat. How would he eat? Who would bring him food? And here now his beautiful personality unfolds. Not that I speak because of want, for I have learned, in whatever state I am, to be self-sufficient. And these things that I say to you, that I rejoice greatly in the Lord, I do not say, because I am in want. Not that I speak because of want. I am not saying this because I have some financial lack. No, no, my joy is not placed there. For I have learned, in whatever circumstances I am, to be self-sufficient. In the things where I am, in the circumstances in which I find myself, I have learned to be self-sufficient. However I am, wherever I am, as I am, to be content with that condition. Little by little, very little by very little, crumb by crumb. What a magnificent passage. First of all, he says that he is not lacking, he is not lacking. Is the apostle lying? No, he is lacking. But if we pose the question, my beloved, who is rich, suppose I give you a piece of paper and a pencil and hold a contest right now. And I say to you, please write the question. How do you think? How do you suppose that a rich man is? In other words, what opinion do you have? Who is a rich person? What would you write? What would you write down? Usually we write what the very word rich also says. Someone who has much. A rich man, my beloved, is not the one who has much, but the one who is satisfied with what he has, whatever that may be. If you need 10 drachmas and your needs are covered, and then you are satisfied, because they are covered, you are rich. If you have 10 million, or 10 billion, or 13 million, and for one moment you feel that something is missing, you are poor. Therefore, the definition of the rich man is this: the one who remains happy and satisfied with what he has. And not by saying, I have this much and I want still more. That is the rich man. Let us not forget this here. Long ago, when we were again here analyzing the book of Kings, I gave you an example. Suppose the late Onassis, who had, they say, 150 or 200 ships. Who knows how many he had? I wonder whether he even knew the names of the ships. Could he remember them by heart? I doubt whether he remembered the names of the ships he owned. So, if he had 200 ships and felt the need, I would like to acquire one more. Because, I do not know. Perhaps he needed it for some business. Then he was poor, because he felt the need to have one more. But the poor man who says, glory to God, I am very happy with what I have, that man is rich. Do you understand? Please. So, do you want to become rich? Do not strive to have many things. Strive to remain satisfied with what you have. And from the moment you are satisfied with what you have, then, my beloved, you will be exceedingly rich, exceedingly rich. These are the true principles of wealth. I do not know whether anyone has any objection to this. Yet the apostle says, not that I speak because of want. I am not saying this because I am in need. He is not lying because he is satisfied. But let us now look at the secret of why he is satisfied, which, if you want to know, concerns us very much. It is what I told you last time, that we would bend down and look through the keyhole of his private life to discover the secrets of how Paul is satisfied, happy, and rich. Even though he is imprisoned, even though he has nothing in this world, even though everyone persecutes him, and yet he is the happy man. In this particular case, how is he happy and rich and satisfied? And while he lacks everything, he says that he lacks nothing. What is his secret? Listen to it. For I have learned, in whatever state I am, to be self-sufficient. For I have learned to be self-sufficient in the circumstances in which I find myself. First revelation, first aspect of his secret. For I have learned. From where did he learn? From where? Was it when he was a disciple? At the feet of the wise Gamaliel, the teacher of the law. Was it there that he learned the secret, my beloved? He learned the secret at the feet of Christ. If you say to me, but historically, the presence of Christ and Paul do not coincide. Paul did not know Christ on earth. That does not matter. We too are able to be disciples at the feet of Jesus, without being contemporaries of his human nature upon the earth. No, quite simply, I become a disciple in the gospel. I become a disciple at the feet of Jesus, and I listen carefully to his teaching. That is where Paul was taught. Therefore the Lord is the teacher. This is the first point. Let us not run around looking for books that will help us learn how to become happy and rich. We will go to Christ. Secondly, what did he learn in Christ? To be self-sufficient in the circumstances in which he finds himself. To be self-sufficient in the circumstances in which he finds himself. This is a great chapter. Self-sufficiency. It is the chapter of self-sufficiency. What does self-sufficiency mean? Self-sufficiency does not signify quantity, but satisfaction. We say, I am self-sufficient. Self. Sufficient means two things. First, that my storehouses are full and I no longer need anything. I am self-sufficient. Second, it does not matter how full my storehouses are. Whatever degree of fullness they have, I am satisfied with the state in which my storehouses are. So this is self-sufficiency from the side of quality. Whether the storehouses are full or whether the storehouses are not full, a person must feel self-sufficient. Further on, he will say, if I have goods in abundance, I have learned to be satisfied there too, although a danger nests there, and we shall see it a little further down. And even if I do not have, again I am to be satisfied. In other words, if the level of my material goods rises and falls, but the level of my satisfaction and of my sense of self, sufficiency does not rise and fall, but I remain steady. What a great thing this is. Paul learned this in Jesus. Once the Lord found himself in the wilderness with 5 loaves and 2 fish, which were only for his disciples, he did not refuse to show hospitality to 5,000 people. And indeed, only the men were 5,000, apart from the women and children. When he received them hospitably and gave them food after multiplying the loaves and the fish, then when the disciples got into the little boat, note that we have 2 such miracles. There is the feeding of the 4,000 and the feeding of the 5,000. And since they are both mentioned by the same evangelist, this is not the same event, with merely some difference in how the crowd is counted. So we have 2 feedings, of the 4,000 and of the 5,000. What I am telling you refers to the 4,000. For in the case of the 5,000, the Lord did not go together with his disciples. He went up onto the mountain to pray. But here, now, he is with his disciples. So as they were traveling in the little boat, the disciples were listening to the Lord teaching them. And at one moment the Lord says to them, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Beware of the ferment," we would say today. How shall we put it? Of the paste. Something like that we would say today, of the Pharisees' paste, of their whole company. When he said leaven, by association, the disciples thought that they had forgotten to take bread with them. And they say, "Lord, no, excuse me." They are discussing among themselves. "We did not take bread." The Lord read what was in their thoughts and says to them, "I am telling you one thing, and you are saying, 'We did not take bread.' And if we did not take any, what of it? Do you not remember how so many thousands of people were filled? How can you now say, 'We did not take bread'? Have you forgotten the way?" So then, the teacher of self-sufficiency is Christ. He is the one who teaches how we are to stand before material goods. From him, then, the Apostle Paul learned. He is the teacher of self-sufficiency. He is the one who, in the strict sense, is all rich. "All things are thy servants, O Lord," Solomon says in one of his prayers, and it is repeated also in our divine liturgy. All things are thy servants. You are the Lord, the possessor of all things, and yet this same Lord comes and teaches us simplicity and self-sufficiency. Does this strike you, beloved? It is astonishing. So Paul learned there to be self-sufficient. What does self-sufficient mean? To be content with what one has. Little by little, much by much. Whatever it is, this is something very beautiful, because all the saints are disciples in the school of Jesus. Saint Isaac tells us the following. When you are about to become a monk, he says, you must take into account that you are going toward death. Whatever happens to you will be less than death, and you will be content. This is the very same thing we are saying here now. Do you know what? When we think that there are worse things, and worse things still, than with what we have, we are content. We are very content. We say, we do not have many goods. But we say, we have our health. or there are worse cases than ours in the matter of hunger, and so on. In other words, whatever we have, we must always be content. And if we take the last and most extreme cases, that these are what we escape, I would say, do you know what? Expect hell. Whatever happens to you will be less than hell. Then you will be content. Are you in the wilderness and you have no water? Or is the water very warm now in the summer? Say this, if I were in hell, would I have water? And what would I want? That the water there be cold and refreshing. Would I have water at all? Is it not enough for me that I have water? Would I want it cold as well? Then I will be very grateful. Or will I say with contempt, throw away this stale water too, because it is not as cool as I would like it to be from the refrigerator. You see, please, there is a well-known anecdote, which you know. Once there was a man who had no shoes to put on. He was barefoot, and he was saying, my God, all my life I have been a barefoot man. I was not able to buy even one pair of shoes. As he was walking along and saying his complaints, he sees a lame man, or rather a man whose legs had been cut off, in a wheelchair, a disabled man. When he saw him, he said, glory to God, I have no shoes, but I have feet. This is what I have been telling you all this time. And when did he glorify God? When shoes came to him. No, it was when he saw that there were other people who had no feet. So the lesson of contentment is a great one. If, my beloved, we had this matter of contentment, we would be very happy, and we would have economic stability, both in our homes and in our society. Today everyone speaks about austerity, yet no one asks for austerity. Programs of austerity are announced, and no one applies them, neither those who announce them nor those who receive the announcement. No one lives all this. On the contrary, we all say, these things are for others. Why do we not become disciples in the school of Jesus Christ, so that we may acquire precisely this great good of self-sufficiency? The apostle even says, having food and coverings, with these we shall be content. Having coverings and food, that is, something to clothe ourselves with, and something to eat, with these let us be content. Why do we seek more? And now he makes the analysis of what he said, that he learned to be self-sufficient. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound in everything. And in all things I have been initiated, both to be filled and to hunger, both to abound and to be in need. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In everything and in all things I have been initiated, both to be filled and to hunger, both to abound and to be in need. I know both. How to be humbled and how to abound. In all things and always I have been initiated, both to be filled and to hunger, both to abound and to be in need. O immortal Saint Paul, what beautiful things you say. I know both how to be humbled and how to abound. Here, to be humbled does not mean in the sense of the virtue, but in the sense of being brought down, being humiliated. That is, when we say, God humbled our people, it means he gave us a blow and humbled us. How? With hunger, with a foreign occupation, and so on, with being disgraced. This, then, is called humiliation, not in the sense of the virtue of humility. I say it again. So the apostle says, I have learned, I know how to be humbled, that is, how to undergo disgrace and humiliations, and I also know how to abound. He knows how to live in any condition. If you give money to a person who does not know these conditions, or to a small child, or to a young person inexperienced in the use of money, then he will enter into temptation and fall into luxury and waste. It is an equal temptation, if not a greater one, my beloved, to have many things than to have nothing, for when I have little, I can still move along humbled, bow my head, and keep silent. But if I have many things, that is a very difficult lesson. In any case, one thing is true, whether I have little, very little, or whether I have much, I am living at two extremes, and these extremes create temptations. The extreme of poverty creates grumbling. The extreme of wealth creates contempt for God, waste, and luxury. That is why the wise Sirach writes with such wisdom, Lord, do not make me. Listen, please, to this watchword of Scripture, for yourselves and for your children. Lord, do not make me either rich or poor. Do not make me poor, lest I blaspheme. Do not make me rich, lest I forget you. Please, hold on to this. Do not want to make your children rich. Do not imagine that there, in wealth, your children will find happiness. Happiness is in self-sufficiency. I stressed this to you earlier as well. Happiness is in self-sufficiency. Teach your children self-sufficiency, or at least, at the very least, and this is most important. Teach them to know how always to order their lives according to the actual conditions before them. When the apostle says, "I know," this is what he means. What does the apostle know? If I am poor, to remain within what I am. If I am rich, not to waste, not to live in luxury. Our age is living through this temptation, not the temptation of poverty, but of wealth. In the time when Greece was poor, did it speak about atheism? Now that Greece has food to eat, there are not many poor people, only very few, even the poorest have food to eat. Judge it, my beloved, by the televisions that exist, so that you may see whether there is poverty or not. Judge it by the televisions. You will say to me, but someone prefers to watch television and does not care about eating. Exactly. You say it yourself. More or less, we have food to eat, and you see our age has fallen away. Our people have fallen away. Because there is self-sufficiency, yet we did not learn how to handle wealth rightly. We did not learn. Are you rich? Then teach your child also to wear patched trousers. Fashion wants the hems to be frayed at the bottom. But even so, no one goes out in patched trousers. No one goes out in patched trousers. I remember that before the war, people wore patched trousers. We went to school with two eyes behind us, the two patches that were sewn on. You remember them. Do you see such things today? Once, about 10 years ago, I saw a young man in Larissa wearing patched trousers. And since he was a young lad, 17 or 18 years old, he was walking faster than I was. I wanted to catch up with him and say, "Bravo, my child, for wearing patched trousers." But I did not catch him. He left. No, patched trousers were not the fashion then. It was a patch, not fashion. They were ironed, washed, simply patched. Those trousers were the patched trousers we knew before the war, not those dirty, frayed ones of today. And those other special kinds they have now, they scrape them perhaps with a brush, even diagonally in certain places, deliberately in the wash, as sailors do to the backs of their collars, rubbing them with a brush, so they may look like old sailors and not like newcomers, not new sailors. Those things are fashion. No, that young man wore trousers, patched not according to fashion, but according to good household order. People do not do that today. They do not do it. I remember rich people before the war, but well-ordered rich people, who taught their children this frugality and simplicity. It is a great thing, not from stinginess, but as a lesson, as upbringing. So I have learned to be in every situation, in everything, and among all things, in every circumstance and in every place, in every need and in every condition, I have been initiated. He uses the verb, my. I have been initiated. This is a very important verb. I have been initiated. I have entered into the mystery, which means into the innermost teaching, for truly, if you know it, the things we are saying are not passing matters. They are the innermost teaching of the gospel. Why are they? The innermost. For, listen to this, it concerns the cruciform training of the gospel, the training of the cross. That is why the apostle uses the verb, I have been initiated, I have been brought into the mystery. And indeed, I would especially like to dwell on this point here, if I were to be asked. What is the upbringing you must give your children? What is this formation? What methods should we use to help our children bring their personality to completion? If you are teachers or parents, how will you raise your children? On the basis of which elements of upbringing? Which methods? It is well known that our age uses the following elements of upbringing. The element of excess, of quantity, of surplus, of overflowing abundance. That is, give the child whatever he wants, so he will not develop complexes. Do not let the child feel that the one next to him, his classmate, is eating chocolate and he has none to eat. Give him chocolate too. Whatever the child next door has, your child must have it too. This terrible rivalry exists, and things become a chain. That is why today, along with other causes, people do not have children. And their argument is that they do not have children because children cost too much. Why do they cost too much? Because this is what exists. It is the upbringing of overabundance, and all this so that children will not develop feelings of inferiority. That is, an inferiority complex. So today the child grows up in abundance, And again, he must not be deprived of his freedom in anything he asks. He wants to go somewhere. Yes, my child, go. I want to go to the North Pole. I want to go to Madagascar. To Honolulu. Go, my child, to Honolulu. You cannot imagine my surprise when I once heard that trips were being organized, even by the University of Thessaloniki, for example, private trips to Honolulu, to the Philippines. I made the sign of the cross. Once, when we studied world geography at school, we considered those points of the earth, very far away, places no one would ever reach. And now I am to go there for a week of recreation, and the child says to you, I need so many thousands of drachmas to go to Honolulu, my child, take them. The father goes and breaks his neck to find the money, so that the child will not be deprived of what he asked for, and so that he will not feel that his personality is being oppressed and his freedom restricted. Or else we leave the child alone, and he wanders around the street, doing strange things and antisocial acts, so that we will not scold him and something happen to him, and he feel pressured and not free to do whatever he wants. I told you once, some months ago, that a gardener of the municipality of Larissa was complaining to me. He said that he tends the rose bushes, and then they go there, up in the park of the fortress, and the children trample them, crush them, play there, lie down there. If you take a walk there, you will see them. These are common things. And he complained to the service, and they answered him, do not say anything. You will tend the rose bushes and the lawn, but do not say anything. In other words, leave the children, the young people, to do whatever they want. This is upbringing today. What is the upbringing of the gospel? As we read here in the Apostle Paul, it is the gospel's discipline of the cross. Have you ever even sensed this? Have you never suspected that the upbringing of children is the gospel's discipline of the cross? Of the cross, I underline that, meaning what? The discipline of self-sufficiency within a very limited measure, whether you are rich or poor. This is the gospel's discipline of the cross. This is what Paul learned. And now that he is imprisoned in Rome, it does not trouble him at all. He is free. So who is free? Free is the one who stands beyond and above his needs. And who is a slave? The one who has demands and becomes a slave to his needs through the inflation of his goods. And when he is deprived of them, he puts a bullet in his head and commits suicide because he can no longer bear the weight of life. Choose, then, and take your choice. This is the gospel's discipline of the cross. Our child will eat legumes and vegetables, too. Yet I recently read a statistic that 70% of young children eat meat, 20% eat fish, and only 10% eat legumes. Why only 10% legumes? Let the children eat meat, too. But why should they not eat more simply? Do we think that all the strength and value of nourishment is in meat? Read the relevant books and see whether the value of nutrition is there, in meat. Read, and you will see. But as we said, we do not want our children to suffer hardship. So I beg you, let us receive this lesson from the apostle, the lesson of the self-sufficiency. He sums up all he has said, that he has learned both to hunger and to be filled, to be in need and to have abundance. He sums it up in a wonderful concise phrase, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It is a saying we can always remember. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Perhaps many people think, how can these things be possible? And yet they are possible because Christ gives strength. And here the apostle is not only summing up the matter of upbringing and food and clothing, but in general, whatever condition a person may be in. Whether he is in sickness, in prison, in exile, disregarded, pushed aside, wherever he may be, however he may be, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can do all things by the power of Christ. All things, I can do all things. A great lesson. Great indeed. Difficult. You will tell me. Yes, difficult. But we have not learned to believe that the school of Jesus has many grades. Usually each grade, according to our educational systems, is 1 year. How many grades are there in the school of Jesus? As many as the years of our life. If we live 70 years, then there are 70 grades in the school of Jesus. That is, we will always be disciples, and we will always be promoted from one grade to the next. Nevertheless, you did well to share with me in my tribulation. He comes back. He spoke as he spoke and stated his position. But perhaps it might reach the point where, after I have now told you so many things, for a moment we have forgotten that they sent money to the apostle. Perhaps they would be saddened if we said to someone, "Why did you give me these things? I have learned to remain in whatever condition I am, in self-sufficiency. I have learned to hunger, and I have learned to abound. So why did you give me these things?" The other person is hurt. Unfortunately, when I was younger, and not even much younger, until recently, I had the impression, and it was egotistical, though I did not understand it, that if I said no to the other person, it did not matter if he was hurt, provided that I did not take what he was going to give me, whatever it was, then I would be perfectly all right. How, then? That again was not the right way to stand, because you know, with these things the apostle writes here, if we do not pay attention to every side of them, we may imitate the apostle, and do you know how we may appear? With an egotistical, harsh attitude toward others. And yet this is not right, because we have not learned the whole lesson. We have learned it crookedly. Here we have learned well that I must remain content with what I have learned in self-sufficiency, but at the same time, I must not offend the other person. It is another matter that at some point one may say no, as the apostle said to the Corinthians, "I would rather die than take anything from you." He had his reason, pay attention, he had his reason. But here he does not want to grieve the most noble Philippians. And while he says to them all that he says, immediately afterward he adds, "Nevertheless, you did well, having shared with me in my affliction. Nevertheless, you did well and became sharers in my affliction." Ah, so Paul was in affliction. Of course he was. He was in prison. What would he have been in? Comfort. Affliction. It does not mean what we say today, "I am afflicted, I am sad." That is the result. Phlipsis, from the verb to press, means to squeeze. We speak of the pressing of olives in the press, the pressing of grapes in the wine press. Phlipsis means squeezing, pressure. So it is as though he says to them, "You did well to share with me in the pressures I am going through." And those pressures, just as when you press grapes, they give out their juice. So a person, when he is pressed by the things of life, gives out tears. And so we learn to call the tears and the pain affliction, while in reality, these are the results of the pressing. That is, of receiving. So then, you did well. Why, nevertheless, what I said to you was good. I gave you a lesson now. You also did well in doing this. Here, when they read it, when they heard the letter being read aloud in the church, they must have said this. The Philippians must have sighed like that and felt relieved. Nevertheless, you did well. The other person feels joy in giving you something. Do not offend him. Take it and say thank you. This is very important. But here he uses the following word. Having shared with me in my affliction, this has great value. When the other person is in a state of deprivation, and we give him something, what is the relationship when we give him something? Simply, an object leaves us. A sum of money goes from us to the other person without us feeling anything. If you like, my beloved, here he shows what the relationship between the giver and the receiver must be. What it must be, the apostle says, having shared. You have entered into communion. You have come into communion with me. He does not say, "You gave to me," because usually when we give something, the story is over. Take, for example, a collection. Someone comes by and says, "You know, gentlemen, such and such a church, St. Demetrios of Larissa, needs icons. We want to make icons for St. Demetrios of Larissa, because they heard something like this, that St. Demetrios wants to have icons made for the iconostasis." So a collection begins, a tray is brought out, "Please give." Each person takes out his wallet, gives something, and then completely forgets it. He gave his money, and that is all. Why should he concern himself with the matter anymore? He gave his money. Therefore, there is no sharing, no communion. There is simply a giving, and it is finished. When there are poor people outside the church, what do? We give 5 or 10 drachmas to a poor man. We did not ask him how he is, how he lives, what he is doing. Nothing. We gave our money and went on our way. That was it. We felt we had settled our obligation. If you knew what an evil thing this is, this shows that we are not sharers, not people in communion. When we give something, we must be in communion with the other person, take part in the other person, live his situation. Once a man was passing in front of a poor man and stopped to give him something. He had nothing. He searched his pockets. He had forgotten his wallet at home. And he said to the poor man, "I am very sorry. I have nothing to give you." But he took the poor man by the hand and greeted him warmly. And he said to him, "Take courage, brother. May God help you in your troubles and your difficulty." And the poor man said, "Sir, many people pass by here and give me money. No one has come to shake my hand and ask me how I am." That is what it means to share in another person's affliction. What do you say now? It is a great thing to become sharers in another person's affliction. It is very great. You see how many lessons the apostle gives us here. You see how he shows us what our relationships with other people should be. Relationships of giving and receiving. The apostle. Because we have not finished. Again, I believed we would finish the epistle today. And again, I have not managed in any way to finish it. I am sorry. Another 8 or 9 verses remain. We did very little. How many did we do? 1, 2, 3, 4, only 5 verses. We did not finish. But the apostle, in every way, wants to show his gratitude. And a little farther down, when the interpreter, Holy John Chrysostom, praises them, he says, "Oh, how weighty the praise! Oh, what praise for the Philippians! And think how Paul paid his thank you, how he paid it. Wherever the word of God is read, the praise of the Philippians is also woven together." In this way, the Apostle Paul, within history, says his thank you to the Philippians. But that is as far as history is concerned. In the history of heaven, there, my beloved, are the Philippians too, whether the Philippians of now or of then, and there also is the Apostle Paul. There, the praise of the Philippians is continually unfolded before the eyes of Christ, just as Paul weaves it. Yes, because acts of virtue have eternity in them, dimensions of eternity, and there all good deeds are unfolded, without ever coming to an end. And Paul too, as you see, is an inexhaustible person. God willing, my beloved, we shall continue next Wednesday.